Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hi, this is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carrillo.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
I'm Leighton Hewitt.
I'm Andy Murray.
This is Yannick Noah, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Tennis Relived, Wimbledon Relived, Day 3. We've taken a trip back to 1978 and 1980, and today we're taking a trip back to 1985. We are firmly now in the territory of David Law's vast and cavernous memory. I don't know if that's a good thing necessarily, but it's where we are. How are you doing, David?
I'm all right. I'm enjoying my trip down memory lane. It's very interesting watching scenes from my childhood that I have not watched since, and trying to find out whether my 12-year-old brain had any sort of accuracy in its conclusions or not.
You couldn't quite remember watching the 1980 Borg-McEnroe final that we covered yesterday, though you were aware of it in your consciousness. Do you remember watching Boris Becker, Kevin Curran, 1985, do you remember where you were?
Vividly, yes.
Go on then.
I would have
More
been...
specifically, do you remember what your haircut was like?
It was appalling. It was probably quite similar to Kevin Curran's, if I'm honest. All sort of curly and wafty. So I would have been 12 years of age. I'd just gone into the senior school, as we used to call it. I was just watching Wimbledon back to back, hour upon hour, and there was nothing else tennis-wise to watch. I didn't even know it existed. I was absolutely fascinated after that tournament to try to find opportunities to see a tennis match with Boris Becker playing somewhere else, to see, because I couldn't understand how does Boris Becker not win every tennis match that he plays, given how hard he hits the ball. I knew nothing of clay courts and hard courts and things like that.
Did, as a 12-year-old, seeing a 17-year-old win Wimbledon, did it make you think, oh, crikey, I'd better, you know, start achieving some life goals? I remember watching Nadal win the French Open and realising we were the same age and thinking, Catherine, you've achieved nothing in your life, so sort it out. I don't know, it could go either way, couldn't it? It could inspire you or it could make you just feel like an utter failure.
No, honestly, no, because at 12, to me, 17 was really old, and 17 was basically a man, and I was such a young child, including for my age. But I look back at it now, and it does make me shudder to think of what this – we're having just watched it, to watch this guy who's 17 – who physically he is an incredible presence, and he's muscular and strong and strapping, but he's got this really young face, and you hear him. We've just heard him interviewed after the match as well, and it does make me shudder to think, my word, this was on his shoulders, and yet it was also very exciting at the same time.
Matt, your formative tennis years will have been spent watching Boris Becker, the pundit, and Boris Becker, the coach. I know, obviously, you'll have been very aware of, you know, what he achieved in his career, but actually watching it back and seeing a 17-year-old Boris Becker, what are you struck by?
Well, it's actually quite difficult to reconcile, as you were saying, the Boris Becker I've always known with this Boris Becker. I actually think that this achievement of Boris Becker winning Wimbledon at 17. Obviously, I've always been aware of it, but and in many ways, it's become a more extraordinary achievement as time has passed and as the sport has got kind of older and it's harder to make those breakthroughs so young. But also, in a way, it's actually one of those achievements which is so of its time that if you didn't live through it, it's really quite difficult to understand the impact that it had and the feeling that it gave people. So it's interesting to go back and read about it and watch it and hear David's memories of it. I mean, what I'm struck by is the sense of belonging that he seems to have on that court. He is striding around the court like he owns the place. He would go on to say that it was his living room, didn't he, Centre Court, famously. But and it's like that. He's walking with such confidence, playing such tennis. Okay, it's one thing to have the game. It's another thing to believe in the game and know that it's a game that you can win. And that just comes through on just as you watch all the match, really.
I didn't walk anywhere with confidence when I was 17.
No.
I was just a crippled sort of ball of angst and self-doubt. I mean, I just can't relate to that at all.
Just everyone stop looking at me. Or yeah. Even though they're not looking at you, you think everyone is looking at you when you're that.
Yeah, kind of age. I think my mum would describe that as the peculiar phase when you didn't like your photo being taken.
Whereas I do recall in 85 and the months that followed in the summer that the local tennis court I would go to, you could see people adopting Becker's mannerisms as they walked around, chest out, really. The way he carries himself is of owning the place.
Did people stop peroxiding their hair?
No, I don't think that they did.
It's suddenly gone out of fashion again in recent years. Boris must feel pretty annoyed at the leadership of some countries that have made bright blonde hair go quickly out of fashion.
And also the name Boris.
Oh, crikey. Double whammy.
Yes, I wonder whether there was like more tennis injuries reported as people were practicing diving across the court on hard courts.
I bet
no question about it, because he normalized diving.
Mm.
It was. I'm sure that there are moments you could find in the history books or archives of people diving around, but not like he was. He made a technique and a tactic out of it. He was coming into the net. He was marauding in, and you will not get the ball past him unless it's the perfect passing shot, because he would hurl himself like a goalkeeper, and he taught himself to dive and be able to roll and get up again. And it just became a trademark of his.
And he's ended up having hip replacements and knee replacements and ankle replacements. And I suppose we'll never know, but you've got to wonder if the way that he flung himself around a tennis court and the, you know, he turned tennis into an impact sport, didn't he?
Yes.
If that, you know, had any kind of an impact. We've jumped the gun somewhat by talking about tennis. If we could row back a bit here and make way for the most important portion of the daily podcast, the scene set for 1985. It was the year when Route 66 was removed from the US highway system. I didn't realize it had been removed, so there we go. New Coke was introduced in what is generally accepted as one of the biggest marketing blunders of all time. It was hated and quickly removed from sale.
New Coke. Right.
Yeah,
I don't remember that.
Rebranded Coke with like new recipe. And everyone was like, well, we liked old Coke.
I was remarking while we were watching it how suddenly from 5 years earlier, which we were watching yesterday, they'd added Diet Coke to the fridge on the court side next to the umpire's chair, which hadn't been released in 1980, but became a staple of my unhealthy childhood.
The entire history of the 80s charted through Coke branding. Greenpeace ship, the Rainbow Warrior, was sunk in New Zealand by French agents to stop her from interfering with a nuclear test. These are things that I didn't know about. I'm learning here. Microsoft released the first version of Windows. British scientists discovered a hole in the ozone layer. Presumably it had been there for a while. Mikhail Gorbachev became the leader of the Soviet Union. The wreck of the Titanic was located. CDs were introduced. Nintendo released its first Super Mario Brothers. The first ever UK mobile phone call is made by a man called, made by Ernie Wise. Is that of Morecambe and Wise?
I don't know. It does sound a bit suspicious. I thought it was
Eric Morecambe and
Ernie Wise.
Right. Somebody Google that while I run through the list of tennis players that were born in 1985.
I thought you were going to say my dad's name when you said the first mobile phone call, because he had one of those house brick phones, you know, and he was so proud.
Oh, yeah.
Of it.
Oh, so did my dad, and it was the most exciting thing that had ever happened at the time. Careless Whisper by George Michael was the biggest selling single of the year. Bet you were into that, David.
Massively.
And Yelena Yankovic, Svetlana Kuznetsova, Joe Wilfried Tsonga, Stan Wawrinka, Thomas Burdick and John Isner were born. Big year.
Lots of players.
It's the kind of lost generation of players in there, isn't there? There's a lot of great players who could have done even bigger things, I feel like, if they were born slightly earlier, perhaps.
And if this weren't a Wimbledon Relived podcast, if this were another podcast about something else that happened in 1985, you would probably put Boris Becker wins Wimbledon as a 17-year-old in your bullet point list of events that happened that year that cut through the noise and made an impact globally and outside of sport, because it was that big a deal. It transcended It transcended sport. It was a news story. He became like we were discussing with Bjorn Borg yesterday, although, you know, far more instantaneously seeming for Boris Becker, he became a rock star seemingly overnight.
He became frighteningly famous, particularly in Germany. They'd never had a player anything like this. They ended up having two in 2 years because Steffi Graf very soon came along and obviously outstripped Becker substantially in terms of career achievements. But in terms of just the wow factor of somebody walking into a room, I think also you add to the equation Boris's look, this strawberry blonde hair, and nobody looked like that. No champion had ever looked like he looked. And yeah, his age, 17. The fact that he's in our list and this is not the most memorable final says a lot about it, as there are a lot of stories that we've had to leave out of the 14, but Boris was one of the first ones in.
It wasn't completely out of nowhere, his title, right? It was unexpected, but not a total bolt from the blue, not only because he'd won Queens a couple of weeks before, talk about that in a moment, but he'd also had a run at the Australian Open as a 16-year-old in 1984 to the quarterfinals there, and he'd reached round three of Wimbledon the previous year as well, but he tore ligaments in his ankle and he actually hopped to the net to shake hands with his opponent, Bill Scanlon, before being carried off the court on a stretcher. So that was his memory of Wimbledon prior to coming in 1985 and winning as a 17-year-old. But as I said, he had started making the biggest waves when he won the title at Queen's, the pre-Wimbledon warm-up event, just a couple of weeks before Wimbledon. He beat the two-time Australian Open champion, Johan Kriek, another South African, in the final. And Kriek had first come across him sometime before. Let's hear from him.
In 1984, I was walking to Ellis Park in Johannesburg to go and play the South African Open. And it's the weekend of the qualifying. And I hear this German guy swearing and fighting with a guy on the court as I walk by. And I look and I see this blonde, reddish-haired German guy, white skin, and he's burnt to a crisp because it's summer in South Africa in November. And he's fighting with Günter Bosch. And I didn't know who they were. These two guys are at it, and the coach is kind of calming him down and da-da-da. So anyway, I didn't take any much more notice. I was just like, wow, that kid is pretty cocky with his coach. You know, he's telling him off and stuff in German. So anyway, I go and play. I go to the semis. And the next year, I'm back on a tour. It's 85, and I'm playing Queens. And didn't know who Boris Becker was. Didn't know. I never look at the draw. I mean, I just play. I don't even look ahead, what I make, nothing. I just play. Next player, I sort of know who they are. Maybe I go and check them out if I didn't, but I didn't check Bucket. So they say, I'm in the finals and I'm playing a schoolboy from Germany. I'm like, what an easy title this is going to be. So I walk on the court and I remember I played him pretty damn even till about 3-all. And then I had sort of a brain fart game that I served badly and I didn't play well. And then he ran off with the first set 5-3 and then ended up winning at 6-4. And then he just got confident. And I mean, he just started serving bombs. And I just remember it was for me, even though it looked now looking at that match, I don't have any of the butterflies and stuff, but I had never seen a guy with a grip holding the racket like sort of an Eastern forehand grip and could hit the ball that hard and flat with such leg jump and stuff. So it was an unusual action for his serve, and he could just absolutely destroy the serve. So, yeah, it was really eye-opener. So when he beat me in the finals, they said, I remember this very stoic guy, I don't know who it was, in the press, said, Mr. Krieg, what do you think about this German schoolboy? And I said, well, if he serves like that, he'll win Wimbledon.
Johan Krieg, the original Paul the Octopus.
Can we get him on the tennis podcast to just do our predictions for us?
He says, if he serves like this, he'll win Wimbledon. Who did he say it to, and can they confirm that story?
Well, he said it in the press conference. That's what he says.
Right, okay.
It's a story that has always been around and has always been told, with slightly different variations on it. But it's great to get it from him. I've seen the match back that they played against each other. And, I mean, that's how it comes across in the second set, is just Boris has once he gets confidence and gets on a roll, how do you stop him? I mean, he's got everything as a grass court player. A massive serve, muscularity. He's got this ability, despite his huge frame, to get around the court and lunge and jump and dive if necessary. How do you get the ball past him? He's got a big forehand, the type of which, okay, he's hitting it flatter maybe than players do today, but he's hitting that powerfully. Plus, he's got an enormous backhand, single-handed, but he wasn't just chipping it. He is driving it. He's often hitting it inside out, fading it away from players with side spin, but driving it. So he kind of had everything back then, particularly for grass with its speed and its uneven bounces.
Really strikes me how different Boris Becker's tennis is to what we were watching just yesterday from 5 years earlier with Borg and McEnroe, where it's mainly about kind of finesse and placing the ball and court craft. I mean, Becker's got that ability, but it's the power that stands out, and just the way he took the sport to the next level in terms of that power is so obvious. And I think that Queen's final, it's almost like Krieg wasn't even there on the other side of the net, because Becker was just serving winners and hitting him off the court. He was just having no impact on Becker's game. And I think the Wimbledon final, to a lesser extent, was a bit like that as well.
So he comes into Wimbledon as the Queen's champion and Johan Krieg's pick for the title, and being talked about, but not necessarily being, universally picked as the future champion, or certainly not that year. And things actually didn't go that smoothly for him in his run to the final. He had to save two match points to beat Joachim Nyström of Sweden 9-7 in the fifth set in the third round. In the fourth round, he beat America's Tim Mayotte also in five sets. And he was behind as well in the semifinals against Anders Järryd. He came through all of those. He ended up facing another South African, a fellow big server, Kevin Curran, ripe old age of 27, 10 years Becker's senior, in the final. And Curran had actually been sharing notes with Becker's beaten semi-final opponent, Anders Järryd, ahead of the final. Let's hear from Kevin Curran.
I remember talking to Anders, and he said to me, I was in total control of the match. He says, the next day we came out, it was really hot and sunny. And he said he blew me off the court. And kind of that's how he played in the finals. He played, I felt like he was going to have 1,000 chances, fearless tennis. And he played like he had been there many times before. I took the attitude that if I just played within myself and I played my game, that he would self-destruct and the pressure would get to him, as a 17-year-old. And I'd practiced with him in earlier that year in April. I think it was in Atlanta at an indoor event. And whilst I recognized he had a big game, lots of really powerful shots that he could hurt you with, he was really inconsistent that day that we practiced. And that was my thing, thinking this kid will never be able to play. And that's where I always believe the majors separate the men from the boys, is that to sustain it over a 3-4 hour period, a 5-set match, that he would never be able to sustain that level, and that there would be a few chinks in his armor. And the actual occasion would get to him. So I wasn't overwhelmed by the fact that I had to play Becker, even though the British media were building him up with each win that he had along the way. Because keep in mind that he won the big pre-warm-up to Wimbledon Queens, and he won it convincingly. You know, so he came in, and keep in mind he was also in the quarterfinals of the Australian Open in 1984. So it wasn't like he just came completely out the blue. But to do it on, you know, the greatest tournament in the world, on the biggest stage, that was the part that really impressed me, that he could play under that sort of pressure as if he had been there, you know, half a dozen times, and he knew what to expect. It seemed that he had that mental fortitude, because I recall seeing McEnroe afterwards on the U.S. hard courts, and he said to me, "I can't believe you lost that match." He says, the level at which you were playing, there's no way you could lose that match. And I said, "Mac, he's a lot better than you think he is." And McEnroe ended up playing him 2 weeks later on hard courts. McEnroe was one in the world at the time, and beat him 7-6 in the third, obviously 2 out of 3 sets, in a tiebreak. And he came in, and we were playing a doubles match after his singles. And he said to me, "I see what you mean. The kid can play." So yeah, Boris, I mean, proved it again. He came back in the following year, defended his title. He won a consecutive years there at 17 and 18, which is just an absolute phenom to be able to do it, you know, at that age.
Mm. I was actually just reading some quotes from the LA Times just ahead of your final. And Boris is saying, "If I win this match, my life will change." And I mean, obviously it did change dramatically. I just wonder what his demeanor was like on the court as a presence. Players have told me in the past that he almost looks like he's trying to intimidate you, the way he stares across the net. What was it like?
Yeah, so guys said that he had this self-belief, and some people even said that, you know, changeovers looked like he was, you know, sort of bumping shoulders with you. I didn't really recognize that in the match. What I was so focused on was, how do I break this guy's serve? Because I thought I had a good serve, and that's where I dominated McEnroe, Connors, and Edberg to some extent, was with my serve. But what I found with him, it was a really hot day. Balls are moving around quickly, plus we played with lighter balls than they do today. So the serve was always a massive factor in those days on grass. It was a much quicker surface and lower bouncing than it is today. So I was having trouble that this guy's consistency on his first serve. And then when he did miss the first serve, he had a really, really heavy second serve. You know, so I hadn't really faced that, a little bit against Edberg, but not against McEnroe Connors. And so that was my difficulty, is I lost serve. I recall my very first service game. So I hadn't dropped serve against Edberg, McEnroe Connors, 9 sets of tennis. And I get out there, my very first serve, I drop serve. And then I was behind for, it took me, I think it was about nearly two hours before we were in the third set, where I finally broke him and got ahead in the match for the first time in the match. I got a 4-3 to go break to serve. And I felt like I was in control of my serve. He wasn't really bothering me too much on my serve. So I felt, now I've finally got him. I've got a chance to win this match. But it had taken, like I say, nearly 2 hours to get to that point. And he broke me back immediately. He played 2 great points, I remember, and 2 good passing shots. And it kind of shocked me, and I was furious. I was livid with myself, because I'd worked so hard to get in this winning position after being behind the entire time and struggling to break his serve. And now I'd given it back immediately. And I remember going into the tiebreaker, And I was still furious with myself that I'd let him in. Ended up losing a tough tiebreaker. He played really well. And then lost my serve first game of the fourth. Again, I was furious with myself with losing that tiebreaker. And it was more the fact that I'd had this chance to get ahead, and now I thought I had him, and losing that momentum. And he just, like I say, on the day, he served like he was going to have 1,000 chances to play that match, you know, over and over. And it was testimony to the makeup of the kid at 17 years of age. But a lot of guys haven't given enough credit to, I think, his support team. So he had a very good coach that he'd worked with from a young age. And he had a guy named Jan Tyriac, who was one of the toughest guys mentally in the game. He used to play Davis Cup for Romania with Ilie Năstase. And whilst Jan was never a great player, he always had this incredible mental fortitude and belief. And I think the fact that he was in his corner at such a young age also was instrumental.
Yeah. Yeah, I was just thinking, you were 27 at the time. He was 17. If you'd have won, it would have been obviously a big deal. But what it became for him, it seemed to just get out of control. I just wonder if you, as the kind of character that you are, would that have been something you would have not wanted to have been in his shoes, given what then happened to him?
Oh, most definitely, you know, because I think that's part of that sort of status. McEnroe, Connors, all of them had it. And your personality, my personality wasn't cut out for that. I was more withdrawn, wanting to, you know, enjoyed playing the game and the competition side of it. But I was never enamored with all the media and all the attention, and that was never part of my makeup. But you know, the Germans were looking for a champion, and obviously Steffi had set the bar on the women's side. But to do what he did at the age he did, he became an instant superstar, and then was able to back it up with the longevity. You know, had a great career. It was unbelievable in Davis Cup. And I've often said to guys that ask me, well, who did I rate the toughest out there to, you know, to play? And I said, well, mentally, if there were two guys that I would choose if they had to play for my life, would be McEnroe and Becker. I said, the bigger the occasion, the more pressure, the better they seem to play. They thrived on that pressure. And there's very few athletes that you can say that about, where the bigger the point or the pressure. And he showed that in Davis Cup as well. He had some amazing wins for Germany and Davis Cup, you know. So yeah, he had that makeup. It was part of his, I felt like on the day I was playing against a whole German Panzer division rather than, you know, just one guy. I just felt that whatever I did, it was this incredible power, and it just it seemed like it was very hard to break through.
Absolutely fascinating and a really lovely sounding guy. He referenced it there, but on route to the final, he beat, well, Stefan Edberg as well, but John McEnroe and Jimmy Connors, and he was the first person ever to do that. And he's actually asked by Bud Collins in one of his many iconic post Grand Slam final bun fight kind of interviews that we've watched Bud do over the course of the last few weeks. He puts that question to him. He says, "Could you ever have imagined that you would beat John McEnroe and Jimmy Connors and not win the title?" And Kevin Curran just has this look in his eye and he says, "Not in a million years."
Yeah. And he beat them in straight sets. I mean, he absolutely thrashed them. And his, back then, I really warmed to Curran. I loved the way he played. And to be honest, I'm embarrassed.
He's underplaying it, folks. We discovered swiftly upon our watchathon this morning that David Law is the world's biggest secret Kevin Curran fan.
This has been the big revelation of the day.
It's awesome. It was great to relive it. But you know, he had this huge serve. He knocked out McEnroe, who to me was the all-conquering tennis player. He'd won in 83 and 84. And 81, so three of the 4 years that I'd been watching tennis, McEnroe had been the champion, only edged out by Connors in 82 in an absolute classic. And I was angry at McEnroe as well, because he'd won the last two finals in straight sets, making them really boring to my 12-year-old eyes. So all I wanted was somebody to knock him out and change things, because I was bored of it. And also, he was always in trouble and he was nasty to people, so I didn't want him to win. And along comes Kevin Curran, lovely Kevin Curran, with his big game, and he smashes past McEnroe. And I don't know, I was a little bit anti the popular feeling, because everybody was interested in Boris Becker and this wonderful 17-year-old story. Because of that, I didn't want it to happen. I wanted the other bloke to win, because nobody was talking about him. But it was really something to witness how Becker just as you kind of described about the way he played against Johan Kriek, just takes the play away, just makes the opponent kind of irrelevant. And there are very few players who have that ability to just render an opponent completely unable to do anything.
And it also really sounded like Curran was surprised by how well Becker returned the ball in that interview he gave with Bud Collins. You know, Curran had served McEnroe and served Connors off the court, and suddenly he's playing Becker, who everyone's talking about his serve, and actually he finds that his own serve is coming back because Becker's able to hit solid returns off both wings. And I think he created a lot of break points in that final, and Curran barely got any on the Becker serve. So, you know, he was having to deal with Becker's serve, but also his return game. And a little story I found that a bit like how Andre Agassi in 1999 at the French Open went to see Bruce before playing his Grand Slam final, Kevin Curran did the same thing before this Wimbledon final, except it didn't work out so well for him.
Can you confirm or deny, Matt, that Bruce schedules his tour geography around Grand Slam tournaments?
No, the Grand Slam schedule around Bruce.
Oh, I set you up for that, didn't I? Perfect. Yeah, I mean, there were echoes in what Kevin Curran was saying to you there, David, of what Sergio Bruguera said when reflecting on his French Open final in 97 against Guga Quirton, that he was just completely guilty of underestimating him, underestimating how well the young upstart would deal with the occasion. Bruguera and Curran both went into their finals thinking, I'll just play a solid game and let him implode, let him struggle to deal with the nerves and the occasion. And they didn't know what they were dealing with, frankly.
It's one of the things that I love about watching Grand Slam finals, particularly when you get somebody playing one who hasn't played one before. And you can sometimes get the player that just is a rabbit in headlights and just can't cope really with the occasion, and others who just come alive and raise their level for the occasion. And it feels quite satisfying to me that a 7 or 8 out of 10 performance is not going to get it done from an established player. That you have to bring it, and if you don't, somebody's going to knock you off. And that's what happened in those two occasions, and there have been many more aside. Think of when Marat Safin won the US Open age 20, and people like this. It's that's what you want really from a Grand Slam final.
Yelena Ostapenko was the one you meant to say there, right?
Well, I mean, that's the ultimate, isn't it? And,
yeah.
because she did it mid-match. That's the other thing. She couldn't hit a barn door, and then suddenly she was the greatest player of all time for about an hour.
I love hearing about hearing people recall their first recollections or what their first feelings were about people that we now feel that we know inside out. You know, Boris Becker is part of the zeitgeist, isn't he? He's just a part of the tennis sporting world consciousness. So hearing people remember what their first impressions of him were when he was just a scrawny 16-year-old, whatever, I find fascinating. And I found some quotes from John McEnroe in a BBC Sport piece after McEnroe experienced him for the first time in Milan in March of 1985, so just a few months before Becker went on to win Queens and Wimbledon. He said, I actually played him about 4 months before Wimbledon that year, and he was sort of bitching and whining and complaining to a lot of umpires, McEnroe remembers. I remember saying to him at the time, why don't you win something before you start complaining? Little did I think that at 17, 4 months later, he would take me at my word. So it seems to me that McEnroe's policy is bitching and whining and complaining to umpires is fine, but you need to have won something first to justify it. Yeah, that's the policy there.
Yeah, I think it kind of is. Although I think it's fair to say McEnroe didn't necessarily take his own advice on that one. But yeah, I think there is a bit of that.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Should we hear from Stefan Edberg, a man who came through the ranks with Boris Becker, played junior tennis with him? I think they met in the first round of junior Wimbledon in 1983. And Becker got the best of Edberg on that occasion. But they, you know, they met so many times throughout their careers. Was Edberg surprised when his contemporary broke through age 17?
I was probably as surprised as everybody else when he won Wimbledon in 1985. I hadn't even won my first Grand Slam at the time, and then obviously gave me also some confidence. Well, if he can go and win at this age, so can I. And back in December 1985, I won my first Grand Slam event in Australia. So it was a great rivalry in many, many ways. And obviously, I think the highlight was probably us playing three Wimbledon finals in a row, nearly a fourth one, stumbling against Michael Stich that following year.
Yeah, great memories. You say there that it was as surprising to you that he won in 85 as it was to everybody else. So you didn't see that coming at all. I mean, obviously he physically was like a man so young, wasn't he? I mean, a little bit like Nadal. He looked so physically imposing. Whoa.
Yeah, they probably had some similarities in many ways. Yeah, I mean, he physically was incredibly strong at the time. And obviously, he won, I think, Queens in 1985 as well. So at least he was up on the radar screen. But, you know, being 17 and a half, as he was at the time, to go up and win Wimbledon, I mean, that was fascinating. But he did a lot great for tennis as well, especially for German tennis. And everything was booming in many, many ways. So I think it was a really, really great thing for tennis when Boris won his first Wimbledon title. So it was good for everybody.
I imagine it was interesting in the locker room at that time. You had so many established champions that everybody knew, McEnroe, Connors, Lendl, players like that. And then obviously you're coming along and you got there pretty quickly as well, but he came like a bolt from the blue. It must have surprised a few people in that locker room.
Oh, we sure did. Yeah, I mean, it was quite incredible when these things happen, because it doesn't happen very often. And obviously he was nearly out of the tournament when he twisted his ankle in, I don't know, in round two or three or something. So he could have actually dropped out by then, but somehow he got back. And you have another few times which I sort of discovered was back in, was it in 1982 when Mats Wilander won the French Open. You know, at the very early stage, there was a huge surprise to everybody else, as Michael Chang winning at the French Open in 1989. Yeah, so these things will happen once in a while, but it's very doubtful. You know, winning a slam at 17, 18 years of age is going to happen today. That is very, very unlikely, if not impossible, the way tennis has sort of progressed throughout the decades.
What did Boris have that was special as a rival for you?
I think he had what a champion has. You know, he could always lift himself for the big occasions. He would always play really well getting into the finals. And at the same time, you know, he was a great personality in many ways as well, physically strong. And, you know, he was a player that a lot of people wanted to watch.
Yeah, he sure was. And it's interesting, isn't it, that you are so different in your personalities. And I liken it to Borg and McEnroe, who were very different but always got along. You seemed, from the outside, you tell me, but it seemed like you and Boris actually got on well.
Yeah, I think throughout the career, there's always going to be, you know, a challenge between one and another when you're on top of the game. But it was always a friendly atmosphere, which I think I had to all players to say. And you know, we never had any problems getting along. And I think it's even, you know, more friendly at the time now when we both can look back at our careers. And, you know, we have so many things in common, so many memories, so many matches. And, you know, we spent so much time in the locker rooms and, you know, as juniors. And you know, now we don't see each other very often. But when we do see each other, it feels always special to meet.
The lovely Stefan Edberg there, sounding suspiciously like Mary Carrillo doing an impersonation of Stefan Edberg.
I think that's what he was going for. he is lovely, isn't he? And he's so shy. He's so unenthusiastic about doing interviews, quite honestly. He'll do the odd one, but I had to really convince him to do that interview. It took about a week to get his agreement. But I always think of the two of them in the same breath, because when you asked about, or you were talking about first becoming aware of Boris Becker, the first time I ever saw Becker was playing against Stefan Edberg, I think at a junior event, not at Wimbledon, but in the UK, an indoor event in the UK, and Becker won the match, and I was sort of supporting Edberg. I don't want to sound like I'm this mad anti-Becker person, but I decided I liked Edberg, and so they came up together. They had, as he said there, the three iconic Wimbledon finals back to back in between 88 and 90. Edberg winning two, Becker winning one. But although they got along, the differences in their lifestyles could not have been more different. Edberg quietly played his career, got married, had kids, retired, and we know he's coached Roger Federer, but he's basically led a very quiet life. He's worked in finance for the last however many years, and I dare say he's got a very, very comfortable existence. Boris Becker's lifestyle has been turbulence personified. It is, I mean, how could it not be, winning Wimbledon at 17? But then I think Rafael Nadal had a very different experience, having won as a very young age. The fame that greeted Becker, it felt like he just wasn't ready for, really. And he does talk about having almost been relieved at the US Open to have lost and not ended up playing John McEnroe, just because of the sheer amount of hype that was going around about him. He was so well known in Germany that he couldn't go anywhere. He couldn't do anything without being mobbed, without being stopped. And I don't know Boris Becker well. I've interviewed him a few times, but we've read a lot of interviews with him. We've read a lot about his life, and it's been all over the place, quite honestly. He won six Grand Slam titles. He was a really great player. I think he could have done even more given the tools he had. But he won three Wimbledon titles. He won the Australian Open, the US Open, semifinals of the French was the best he did there, and some wonderful wins at the ATP finals at the end of the year. He got to world number one. So he did a lot on the court. But, you know, his private life was difficult for him at every turn. And, you know, we've read a lot of stories over the last couple of years: bankruptcy, selling his trophies, untold riches, and then financial problems, it would appear. So he's had a really, really messy life. But the flip side is, I know people who would say he's had a very exciting life. I suppose it depends which way you come at it.
Yeah, I was surprised by how quickly it seemed to impact him, that US Open you referenced there, just mere months after this Wimbledon win. Because obviously, when you just look at the career arc of Becker, you think, oh, well, he defended his Wimbledon title the next year. Maybe things were going swimmingly. But it seems that right away, the level of impact just kind of was too much to bear. I think he got a congratulatory telegram from the Chancellor of West Germany straight after. I mean, getting your head around that as a 17-year-old, arriving back in Germany, and I think he said, in West Germany, I think he said that his town had 20,000 people, and he got off the plane and there were 50,000 people there suddenly. And people have likened his fame in Germany to the sort of fame that Michael Jordan experienced over his basketball career. And just, I don't know, this idea that success in many ways can make life easier, but it can make living a lot harder because you've got a lot more to deal with. And it doesn't seem that he maybe surrounded himself with the people to help him through that. I mean, maybe Nadal, perhaps that was something that Nadal had that Becker didn't. Because seeing him now is quite sad in a way. He's become almost the butt of some jokes and a bit of a caricature of himself. And knowing that he had this incredible tennis career to have spiraled into the life that he's had is just a bit difficult.
Too often, certainly not just Becker, but players that have extraordinary success very young, it feels like there's an element about them that's kind of frozen in time at that age, at that moment when they first had their taste of success and stardom. And I think there is an element to that with Boris Becker. You know, was he ever able to do any real growing up beyond that point? I read that his grandfather, after whom he was named, his middle name's Franz, after his grandfather, he passed away on the eve of Wimbledon in 1985, and his parents debated whether or not to actually tell him about that. And eventually they decided they should tell him, and they did. And Becker says he sourced emotional strength from that. But, you know, it occurred to me hearing about, you know, that trip back to Germany and what he was confronted with and the instant fame and fortune, would he ever have had a chance to grieve his grandfather's death? You know, or from that moment onwards, literally from that moment, once the Wimbledon 85 started, he was just on a treadmill, wasn't he? And I know aspects of that treadmill were absolutely fantastic and wonderful. And I know some people find it hard to feel too much sympathy for someone with great fame, fortune and success. But asking a 17-year-old to deal with all of that without the opportunity really to do some very necessary, essential aspects of growing up and, you know, rites of passage and milestones and so on is an incredible ask.
He grew up in front of our very eyes. There was a really good interview with him this week by Mike Dixon in the Mail that I'd recommend anybody reading, just to get to try to get Boris's view on what it was like back then. Because I must say I'm not always convinced that he will have the sort of recollection that maybe somebody detached from it might have, who was there fly on the wall type of experience. But it is interesting the detail he seems to remember that particular Wimbledon in. There's another piece that I read a short while ago by Scott Price from Sports Illustrated, who also pointed out that when Boris Becker's married for the first time to Barbara Felters, they had to deal with an incredible level of racism within Germany, because he was marrying a black woman. And it was awful what they had to deal with, and he stood up as strongly as he possibly could to that. I just feel like at every stage of his life it has been turbulent. He's never had a quiet life, it would appear, but I also don't know whether he ever could have done. I don't know A, whether that was possible, and B, whether he ever wanted that. I think he was probably slightly addicted to the lifestyle that he ended up having.
Yeah, it my experience of him, and I've always, you know, enjoyed working with him. He's always been, I don't ever really feel like I've got to know him, but he's always been extremely polite and pleasant and everything. My experience or my interpretation of sort of observing him at Grand Slams and so on is he's caught between a rock and a hard place. He kind of resents and detests the downsides of the attention, but he also completely requires it. He feeds off it. He needs it. I don't know if he knows how to exist without it. You can see, you know, when he's, of course, he attracts instantly recognizable in a crowd. He's got that shock of blonde hair. And whereas Mats Wilander walks around Roland Garros with a baseball cap on, sort of with a shuffly demeanor so as not to be recognized, Boris Becker wants to be recognized, and that's fine. But elements of that, you know, also make him uncomfortable. And it's this, you know, it's almost this Stockholm syndrome type relationship with fame and notoriety.
Yeah, there's an interview with him in The Guardian in 2009 where it's like a profile interview that they're having that's, I think, conducted in a restaurant, and the restaurant has closed off a private part in the back for them to have the interview. And Becker says, oh no, let's sit out the front here in the front window. And he has his back to the window so that he doesn't have to see people walking past, but he will know that everyone will kind of recognize him by the back of his head. And the writer says it's like he lives his life in the front window in terms of wanting that attention. And it does feel like he's not content with being Boris Becker, six-time Grand Slam champion, three-time Wimbledon champion. He's had to find these ways, whether it be the poker or the commentary or the coaching or whatever else it is, to sort of, I don't know, maybe justify in his own mind the fame he had, or just still be relevant today. And he just seems to find these ways, and a lot of the time it gets him into trouble, and he's his own worst enemy in that sense.
Quite tough to see him physically these days when we're at Grand Slam tournaments. You see Stefan Edberg, and they're similar ages. I think Edberg's a little older. But it's not
fair, David, to compare any man with Stefan Edberg who hasn't aged since 1986.
No, well, that's true. But Boris, I mean, he's had so many surgeries, knees, ankles, properly reconstructive surgery to rebuild parts of his joints. And when you actually see that match he played against Curran today, and even more so, I think, when you watch him on hard courts and indoors against Sampras and Agassi and players like that, and still serving a volleying, still coming to the net, still lunging with these enormously heavy limbs that he had. He was so heavily muscled, just a big strapping guy carrying a big weight around. And he was incredibly athletic for somebody of his size. He could make that work as a career. But the stress that has clearly put on his body over the years has told. And he shuffles around now, and it's quite hard to see.
Yeah, I got advice from Boris Becker on how to manoeuvre on crutches.
Did you take that advice?
Which is a sad story in itself. I mean, I was taking any advice I could get at the time, Matt. It wasn't pretty in the early days. It is. I mean, he's. I mean, I'm sure a lot of it is really bad fortune, but. Yeah, what's happened to his body over the years is incredibly sad. You know, I mean, he's partly recognizable because of his gait, and it's hard for him to escape crowds because he can't move that quickly. He can cut quite a forlorn figure, but he can also still cut a really electrifying figure because he does still have that shock of blonde hair, and he is so magnetic still. It's all these bundles of contradictions. You spoke to him, David, at the Australian Open this year, briefly, I think. And we're going to hear a quite a poignant clip from that interview now, quite a short one, and you'll hear why. Because you asked him at the end of that interview what advice now, aged 52, he would give to his 17-year-old self. And this is what he had to say.
It's a long time ago, my friend. I'm 52 years old now, so I don't remember too much when I was 17. In a time so different, we had no internet. The world was different. Tennis, you know, thankfully we had tennis tournaments, but it was very different to now. So, if all the things I know now, if I would have known then at 17 or 20, obviously my career would have been a bit different. Probably more successful. Not saying mine wasn't, but you're always smarter when you get older, and you would do things differently 25 years ago.
Short shrift? Is that how we'd describe that?
Well, I was part
Shortish
of a group.
Shortish shrift.
I was part of a group talking to him about Tennis Today and all those sort of things. And actually, I mean, the parallel I was drawing really was Coco Gauff at the age of 14, 15, trying to navigate her way in this sport and getting all this attention. And I've always been fascinated by Boris, having seen him at 17. I've always wondered what he makes of it all, whether he's ever had properly chance to think back and think, oh, I wish I hadn't done this or that, you know. And I just wanted to ask him. He wasn't, I don't think he was very happy with the question, to be quite honest with you. I don't think he liked it particularly. You probably heard that.
But that tells you something, doesn't it?
His
discomfort with the question. When I think back to, I'm not judging him here, but think back to how incredibly reflective Chris Evert was about her, you know, her experience of success young and what she now considers to be poor decision making and how open and undefensive she is about those aspects of her life. I mean, she's obviously been through therapy and really worked hard on all of that. But Boris sounds to me like he's taken the other road of sort of just not wanting to think about it, not wanting to reflect
on
it.
Head down, move forwards is how he comes across. I also did just want to briefly touch on his coaching career, because he was with Novak Djokovic as part of that team for 3 years. And it's always difficult to know how much impact a coach is having on a player or versus how much impact, say, Marin Vida had. But Novak Djokovic had enormous success during that period as well. And I do feel that just the messaging of somebody who'd been there and done it did help Djokovic for a period, particularly at a time when I think he was probably feeling a little bit inferior in his own mind to Nadal and Federer, just in terms of the kind of stature they had in the sport. Even though his own achievements were spectacular on their own, I think just having Boris in his corner really helped him feel bigger than even he was.
Yeah, I think there was a period there where, I mean, because Djokovic had that breakthrough in 2011, but then it slightly stagnated. He was still kind of the best player in the world, but he wasn't transferring it into slams. I think 2012 and 2013, he only won one slam, and then Becker comes along, and yeah, you're right. I mean, the best period of Djokovic's career coincided with Becker being in his box in terms of 2015, especially, and also 2016. And he turned into this incredible big match player, Djokovic. And that is something that Kevin Curran just said in that interview that we heard, that if he wanted a player to play in a big match, it was Boris Becker. And it's kind of difficult to put your finger on maybe exactly what that was. Becker said to him. Yeah.
Boris never feared any opponent or any occasion. The bigger the opponent, the bigger the occasion, the bigger he became. He pushed out his chest and he seemed to grow a couple of inches. And yeah, what a force he was.
And if you're ever in need of any inspirational quotes, they can be found daily on Boris's Instagram page, #word.
Excellent.
Yeah, so that's Boris Becker, youngest ever Wimbledon champion. He must have been annoyed when Michael Chang came along and won the French Open a couple of years later. Just mere days younger than him to steal the youngest male Grand Slam champion title away from him, but he's still the youngest Wimbledon champion.
Will it ever be broken, that one? I mean, I'm not sure it will.
I mean, to say never feels ridiculous, but I don't see it being broken in the foreseeable future. Tennis would have to change substantially for it to be broken. I mean, the age of maturation for male tennis players is getting older, not younger. So there'd have to be a significant shift in direction of travel there for it to be broken. But it surely will be one day. Where are we going tomorrow, Matt?
We are going to 1991. I'm very
the 90s.
Very excited about this. A, the 90s, and B, because it's Steffi Graf versus Gabriella Sabatini in an absolute classic final.
If it, one of the main things that Tennis Relived has done for me is make me into a massive Gabriella Sabatini fan. Again, I mean, I was sort of age 5 because I liked her hair, but now I'm a more mature, considered Gabriella Sabatini fan. A late adopter.
I was going through a gargantuan rough patch, Boris Becker style. So
in 1991?
Are
these the lost law years?
This is the utter derailment of the law.
I cannot wait. That's for tomorrow, day 4 of Wimbledon Relived. I'm absolutely loving them. I really am. It's such a joy and such a pleasure. Boris Becker is the perfect example of one where I knew he won Wimbledon in 1985 as a 17-year-old, and probably previously I felt like it was enough to know that, but now I know all the richness of the context and the stories behind it and the significance of it, and I'm so glad I know all of that. And I'm so glad I've had the opportunity to have Matt's current lockdown hair compared to Kevin Curran's circa 1985. That also was a treat. By David, I should say, not by me. Hello to Gerald, our Wimbledon mascot. Excellent, excellent Gerald. Building up a head of steam on Instagram. He's practically an influencer now. He won't need us soon. But hello, Gerald. And thank you, David and Matt. We'll be back tomorrow with Graf against Sabatini and our first trip to the 90s. We'll see you then.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.